Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and I'm coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become that you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. This is where the past meets the future. The solar wind tonight is a mild 350 kilometers per second. And there are only three sunspot clusters on the sun today, none of which are flaring. There are some solid theories gaining support that this mild solar cycle, by the way, may precede an ice age. I know it's always tempting to say, it's an ice age when it's winter time. But it really doesn't take much of a scientist to notice that the weather has made a shift in patterns. The winters are colder and the summers are hotter everywhere. Europe, Australia, Asia, and the Nordic regions. The glaciers are growing each year, and the jet stream seems to be tied to solar magnetic fields that we are just now recognizing. In the coming months, we'll try to find some real experts to help you be prepared and to be aware of what may be coming. For now, keep warm, Earth Explorers. Tonight it's 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We have a special guest coming on with us. We have Miss Brenda Williams. The Triad Wave is a unique and proprietary technology created by Brenda Williams after she was diagnosed with aggressive cancer in 1990. Sitting on her porch, watching the wind and the trees, the movement of the birds and animals and the clouds in the sky, Brenda became aware of subtle patterns of movement. And then numbered sequences began coming into her mind over and over again until she finally took the sequence to a recording engineer. As the engineer created the sequence in audio form, they saw a wave appear on the computer screen. Although they couldn't hear the sequence, they could feel it, and so could everyone in the waiting room outside of the soundproof studio. Those of you who wonder whether or not we are eternal beings having a mortal experience need only experience the alteration of your human frame in a matter of hours, by a frequency or an energy in a way that no one can deny. I can tell you from personal experience that this energy exists and that it is accessible in this world and in this dimension. Listen to this interview tonight with Brenda Williams and see for yourself. 6 p.m. Hang in there, less than an hour away. By the way, pay no attention to that phone in the background. It's not for me. Those of you who are dog owners, I am both a dog owner and a former dog owner because I regularly outlive my dogs. The U.S. military is set to scan puppy brains to find the most suitable war dogs. Now, there's a good name for a band. Hello, Philadelphia! It's the War Dogs! Nah, maybe not. Anyway, they've developed functional imaging to develop outstanding service dogs. Believe it or not, they call it FIDOs, Yeah, FIDOS. It's a scheme that will use MRI scans to monitor puppy reactions. The military says the scheme will allow it to optimize the selection of ideal service dogs. When we go to war, they go to war. Throughout the histories of warfare, from the days of the Egyptians, the Greeks, and the Persians, and the conquests of the Roman Empire, to the United Nations police action in Korea, the war in Vietnam, the Gulf War, and more recently during the war in Bosnia and Kosovo, dogs have undergone active service at the sides of their masters. They have played the role of hero by showing bravery under fire, saving lives, often by sacrificing their own and bringing comfort to the injured and infirm. Attila the Hun used giant Milesian dogs, precursors of the Mastiff, and Talbots, ancestors of the Bloodhound, in his campaigns. Attila the Hun also had a great saying, "It is not enough to win, all others must lose." During the Middle Ages, war dogs were outfitted with armor and frequently were used to defend caravans. And in the Seven Years' War, Russian dogs were used as messengers by the army of Frederick the Great. Napoleon had dogs posted as sentries at the gates of Alexandria in Egypt to warn his troops of any attacks. They were probably Pekingese. They'll bark at anything. Two centuries earlier, on this side of the Atlantic, they helped the Spaniards conquer the Indians of Mexico and Peru. Then, later on, it was the native North American Indians who were to develop the use of dogs for pack and draft work as well as for sentry duty. In the early part of the 14th century, the French Navy started to use attack dogs in St. Malo, France, to guard naval dock stations. These were used up to the year 1770, by the way, when they were abolished after a young naval officer was unfortunately killed by one of the dogs. The first recorded American canine corps was during the Seminole War of 1835 and again in 1842 in Florida and Louisiana, where Cuban-bred bloodhounds were used by the army to track the Indians and runaway slaves in the swamps. And during the bleakest time in the history of the United States, the Civil War, dogs were used as messengers, guards, and as mascots. In 1884, the German army established the first organized military school for training war dogs at Lechernick near Berlin, and in 1885 wrote the very first training manual for military war dogs. In 1898, during the Spanish-American War, dogs were used by Teddies, Rough Riders, as scouts in the jungles of Cuba. By the early part of the 20th century, most European countries were utilizing dogs in their armies and for police work. In 1904, Imperial Russia used ambulance dogs during the Russo-Japanese War, trained by a British dog fancier who later went on to establish the first army dog school in England at the start of the Great War. The Bulgarians, the Italians, the Germans, the French, the Belgians, and then in 1988, the Israeli Special Forces sent bomb-carrying Rottweilers on a suicide mission codenamed Blue and Brown against enemy bunkers in Lebanon. And when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, the East German communist government was using 5,000 dogs just to patrol the wall and another 2,500 watchdogs plus 2,700 so-called horse dogs to patrol their borders. By the way, during the Gulf War, at least 1,177 highly trained German shepherds were used by the French forces to guard and protect their troops. The USA only used 88 teams of dogs. But it was initially during the days of the Roman Empire that entire formations of attack dogs, frequently equipped with armor or spiked collars, were sent into battle against the enemy as a recognized and effective instrument of offensive warfare. However, recently, with the development of modern long-range warfare and the consequential change in military tactics, the value of dogs as combat soldiers has steadily diminished. But at the same time, their usefulness in other military activities has increased. So now Pentagon bosses are planning to develop puppy brain scanning technology so they can spot the best dogs to train for the armed forces. According to a new research solicitation from DARPA, the project, codenamed FIDOS, will use magnetic image resonator scans to look for puppies that show potential. The project specifications say it will optimize the selection of ideal service dogs by scanning their brains to find the smartest candidates, while real-time neural feedback will help optimize training. This effort will capitalize on first-of-its-kind neural imaging feasibility work demonstrating functional brain activation in unrestrained dogs in response to handler cues, a document outlining the plan said. The objective of this effort is twofold. First, to optimize the selection of ideal service dogs, both in operational, military, and therapy environments, and second, to use real-time neural feedback to optimize canine training, shortening training duration, reducing costs, and increasing learned responses. And I would say that there's a third, which I will explain to you in a moment. Dogs are used throughout the U.S. military to sniff for bombs, detect drugs, and even take part in advanced missions, such as the mission to kill Osama bin Laden, where the unidentified canine used in the mission was lowered into the compound from a helicopter while strapped to a human member of the team. They often skydive the same way. The Pentagon reportedly has about 2,700 dogs, most bought from Europe, where the best breeding lines for such work are generally based. Each dog, by the way, costs about $20,000 just to train. The agency believes it may be possible to use technology to screen high-value service dogs based on their neural activation to specific handler training cues. Dogs who show greater brain activity when given such cues will be faster and easier to train than dogs that show less activity. The work could also help spot dogs suited for social tasks, such as rehabilitation, it is claimed. Advances from this program could also be transitioned to the Veterans Administration, which is running a clinical trial on the impact of therapy dogs on the lives of veterans diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Understanding the mechanism and communication between canine and human will facilitate therapy dog support for veterans with PTSD. Now, the third lesson learned from doing this is to watch the stimulus response using the MRI, learn enough about dog brains and the way dogs react to taking orders and following instructions, and an aptitude for learning, and perhaps do the same thing with human brains, so that humans at a very early age, maybe part of their early elementary school formation, can be subjected to stimulus in response, and their brains can then be monitored by MRI harmlessly to determine which students would make the best soldiers, which students would make the best factory workers, which students would make the best college professors and teachers. So it doesn't go by the likes and dislikes of the person, the sovereignty of the person, but more a stimulus response and scanning system. Now, they can do it with dogs because dogs don't vote. Dogs don't have rights. We do everything to dogs. We stick makeup in their eyes. We let them smoke cigarettes and take drugs. We let them wear patches and various kinds of ointments and different kinds of appendages to see what they do. The clinical testing is done on monkeys and dogs. And when they pass, when they're really good, then they get to go to war. By the way, don't forget, if you've just joined us, it's about 16 minutes after the hour. Brenda Williams is going to join us at 6 p.m. Pacific time tonight, and she's going to be talking about the development, her discovery of the triad wave. Those of you that are not familiar with it, the links are on the website at X Squared Radio, and you can Google it and learn what you can about the triad wave, but I promise you're not going to learn more than you will tonight right here in about 45 minutes. Everybody knows, except for maybe those people in Boston tonight, that the Earth has been getting warmer. But how much of that heat is due to greenhouse gas emissions and how much is due to natural causes? Well, a leaked report by a United Nations group dedicated to climate studies says the heat from the sun may play a larger role than previously thought. Who would have thought? Well, the results do suggest the possibility of a much larger impact of solar variations on the stratosphere than previously thought. And some studies have suggested that this may lead to significant regional impacts on climate, reads a draft copy of a major upcoming report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. The man who leaked the report, he's a blogger who has a blog called Stop Green Suicide. His name is Alec Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, disclosed that the UN's statements on solar activity were his main motivation for leaking the document. The main premises and conclusion of the IPCC storyline have been undercut by the IPCC itself. No kidding. The public needs to know how the main premises and conclusions of the IPCC storyline have been undercut by the IPCC itself. And so he says the UN should be blamed for burying its point about the effect of the sun in Chapter 11 of their own report, even after the IPCC acknowledges extensive evidence for solar energy forcing beyond what they included in their models. They still make no attempt to account for this emission in their predictions. Alex says it's insane, but it's probably typical and very political. I mean, come on, who's going to make money? Who's going to be able to take over an industry if that pesky sun is to blame for global warming and for climate change? The solar component is real, but not of sufficient magnitude to have driven most of the warming of the late 20th century. Pat Michaels, the former president of the American Association of State Climatologists and current director of the Center for the Study of Science and the Cato Institute. I think he is also the deputy director of paper towels at that organization. I think that's scientifically irresponsible to say that the sun and the solar components are not of sufficient magnitude to have driven most of the global warming of the late 20th century. It's clear that the solar cycles have not been going as predicted, or should I say, not going along with the pattern of times of old. Solar cycle 24 is way out of the ordinary. The span that we have gone without sunspots is unprecedented. The lack of solar flares. By this time in solar cycle 24, we should have seen at least several dozen X-class flares. Not been the case. Most solar cycles have at least 100 X-class solar flares. And we have many, many coronal mass ejections that are associated with coronal holes, with solar flares, with filaments, with all kinds of magnetic anomalies. We now have the equipment up there with the Solar Dynamics Observatory and with SOHO to be able to monitor these types of things. And maybe it's because we're looking, but they're just not happening. And the fact that they're not happening is having direct effect on the upper atmosphere, the generation of cosmic rays, which those of you that listen to this program know, cosmic rays are generated when high velocity, high energy particles ejected by the sun make the 93 million mile trip, strike the upper atmosphere, strike molecules in the upper atmosphere, sputtering off electrons, which then cause electrons in higher orbitals of those molecules to drop in to fill the space left in the lower orbitals, and that drop generates a photon called a cosmic ray. Those rays are not in the same frequency as those that came flying in from the sun, but they tend to cause high altitude particles and haziness, which can absorb sunlight in the upper atmosphere and actually help create upper atmosphere. This is not the UV that we're talking about. These are actual high energy particles that come into the upper atmosphere. Climate science has the problem, of course, of trying to explain why we are now in our 17th year without a significant warming trend. Remember, about 1997, the warming stopped. It climbed up to that point, and when I say climbed, it was just a very gentle rise, not even a degree. But in 1998, it leveled off, and we haven't seen a warming trend since then, and nobody really knows why. We don't know if it's because we're in a new neighborhood of the galaxy. We don't know if the solar wind, being at such remarkably low velocities for such a long period of time, you know, around 300 to less than 400 kilometers per second, we don't know if it's because the sun has not flared the way that it has in the past, and this has vastly lowered the energy and the frequency of the particles and frequencies that that strike the Earth. And we also don't know that it's not magnetic in its source. We have just recently discovered that the sun, of course, holds the Earth in its orbit, slinging it around, you know, like a ball on a string. In its orbit, elliptical orbit, some 93 million miles from the sun, plus or minus 50,000 miles or so. But that there are magnetic ropes, as it were, it's hard to describe, actually, strings almost, like ribbons that go between the Earth and the sun. And, in fact, may stretch across vast distances of space, not millions, but billions of miles, tying our solar system to other stars and other bodies that aren't stars in our own galaxy. In fact, there are many that believe that our sun is actually one of two suns in a binary system. Our sun and the star Sirius, or something really close to Sirius that's very high gravity, around which our sun orbits. Now, I know it's a little bit difficult for you Romulans to think of this, but you've been brought up wrong. I mean, to think about the solar system as this flat disk of accretion matter that now forms a solar system with the sun in the middle and around nine planets and a few hundred asteroids floating around it in a flat disk in the quiet calmness of space. But nothing could be further from the truth. The truth is that the sun itself is pounding its way through the solar, through the galaxy, and the planets are following it in a sort of spiral kind of formation. As the sun races through space, of course, it's spinning on its axis about once every 28 days. We have roughly 9 planets and a whole lot of matter that are following along behind it, spiraling, sort of. So the whole formation doesn't look like a flat disk. It looks like a tornado going through the blackness of space with the sun leading it, you know, at the very front. So as we go through, you know, the orbit through the precession of the equinoxes, as it were, all of the planets in the solar system are following along behind you. We're all being exposed to different different frequencies, different particles, different areas. And this has changed as we go forward through space. Now, Earth goes around the sun at about 18.5 miles per second. And, you know, we pretty much see the same thing every 365.25 days. But the sun, in its orbit of almost 26,000 years, is dragging the planets also through new regions that, well, ages of mankind are seeing as brand new, or so to speak. If we think of mankind being on the Earth, oh, I don't know, 60,000, 120,000, 180,000 years, wow, we've only made what? 5 orbits around the central sun around which our sun revolves. That's not many orbits, and lots of things change in space during that time. So as this happens, we get exposed to new frequencies and new energies. It may or may not be regular in that sense. Like Tuesday, we're going to see this. 4, we're going to see that. In June, we're going to see this. It doesn't happen that way. It's a much longer cycle than that. And things change in space. And as they change, we show up, and it's a new story. So when we monitor the temperature of the Earth and we say, gee, it went up by 1 degree over the last 20 years, and we say it's global warming. Ah, we've got to have a new political party. We've got to raise money. We have to change leadership in Washington. We have to tax people more. We've got to tax everybody more. But in reality, that's not what's happening at all. Now, the question always comes up. I hear this all the time. What the heck are we doing? I mean, come on. I see climate contrarians try this trick almost every time a big new solar study comes out. They somehow trend to neglect mentioning that solar variation is smaller than the heart-trapping power of, say, carbon dioxide or methane in the atmosphere. Well, that's true. That's true. But what about the gazillions of tons of CO2 that we dump into the atmosphere of Earth that don't have anything to do with normal respiration? Respiration, by the way, is one of the sections of the life cycle of animals on a planet. And it is also taken up by the photosynthesis process of plants. CO2 and sunlight and water and certain minerals are used by plants to make sugar and cellulose and protein. Hence, that's what supports all life on Earth, by the way. Everything from algae to kumquats are generated by using CO2 and sunlight and water and minerals. So if we don't make CO2, guess what the plants do? They suffocate. So if we're making so much excess CO2, shouldn't there be like a jungle flourishing on the Earth? Well, the fact is, there is. And a lot of people say, well, gee, you know, the rainforest, it's been dying. Well, it's been dying because we've been cutting it down. But the rainforest, at least mature trees, they don't make oxygen. Why? Because they're not growing. The rainforest, they don't shed leaves on a seasonal basis. These plants that aren't growing don't make oxygen. The fact is they make CO2. And in some cases, because of the bacteria that lives on them, they make methane as well. So it's only the growing forests that make oxygen. In other words, if you cut down the forest and then you replant the trees and the trees take 30 or 35 years to grow back, that forest is making oxygen. The old growth, sorry, doesn't make oxygen. But that's not really the big oxygen maker anyway. The big oxygen maker is the ocean. That's a fact. 4/7 of the earth is covered in seawater. And what lives in seawater are various types of algae. Now, they only live in the top 6 inches of the water, so not to fear that they're going to turn the whole ocean green. But that's where most of the oxygen comes from. That's where the oxygen comes from in the seawater to support all the animal life that lives in the sea. And that's where the oxygen comes from to support most of the atmosphere of the earth. Most of the water that goes up into what we call the atmospheric river, the AR, that flows around the planet, billions of gallons per day, most of that comes from the ocean. Most of that water contains rich, clean oxygen. And as it rains down through the atmosphere in various places, when cold fronts meet warm fronts, if you don't believe me, just talk to the folks up at Boston right now. They just got 3 feet of it. Is perfectly clean distilled water, rich in oxygen, goes right into the soil and feeds the aquifers, and it has been doing that ever since the earth cooled. So global warming is a normal part of this process. However, the normal ecosystem takes into consideration all of the cubic feet of life on this planet that normally respirates. But mankind does not normally respirate. Not at all. Our energy systems, at least the way that we operate them now, by burning coal and burning natural gas, for about 40% of our electricity that we use, at least in the United States, it's much higher than that in other nations, by the way, that belches out into the atmosphere at many times what human normal breathing activity and all of their pets and domestic animals could possibly put out. So it has an effect. It has an effect on the chemistry of the atmosphere. And that, of course, since the Industrial Revolution, has been a cosmic snapshot. It's been a flashbulb in the development of the Earth. But the fact that it is a flashbulb, the fact that we're belching all of this climate-changing, planet-changing chemical into the air in a very short period of time, not like a volcano, which has a sudden eruption and puts a lot of particles and acids and sulfurs and things like that in the atmosphere. But it's localized. It's localized. And it's acute. That doesn't mean that it's good looking. I mean, it's a short period of time. You know, Pompeii, Krakatoa, Mount St. Helens, blah, blah, blah. It's a short period of time. If you go up to Mount St. Helens now, the only thing that you see that's different is there's a section of the country where the trees are shorter, but all the trees are back, and the sky is blue, and corn is growing in Nebraska as though a volcano never erupted in Washington. It's a short period of time. When it begins to have an effect is when it is chronic. That is to say, yes, you slip and fall down and you bang your knee, but then you heal, you get up, you walk away. But if you slip and fall down and bang your knee every single day, it's going to have an effect on you. chronic effects that mankind is generating over a long period of time. Yes, it's only been about 150 years since we've been doing it, but it is now turning into a chronic effect. We have now gone through many solar cycles doing this. We have been through many generations doing this. We have now spanned across continents. Every corner of the world we're doing it. And it's now forming bands of these chemicals around the planet over and over and over again. I'm not just talking about CO2. I'm talking about chlorofluorocarbons. I'm talking about solvents and not just fugitive emissions, but plants that send out these fumes out of their stacks. No, we can't do that very much in every state in the United States now, because since the 1980s, we've started to become more environmentally aware. Hello? It's only been about 25 years since these environmental controls have been in place, and they're not as stringent in some states as they are other states. And they're definitely not as stringent in some countries as they are in the United States. So, when climate skeptics are arguing on the internet about drafts of the report from the IPCC, and states like New York and New Jersey are working to help people rebuild their homes in ways that, you know, have a better chance of surviving more destructive storms and flooding in the future, all of this has a kind of political effect. But when you realize that almost no sunspots were observed on the sun's surface during the period from, oh, I don't know, let's say 1650 to around 1715, this extended absence of solar activity may have been partly responsible for the little ice age in Europe. I say may, but it did. Okay, temperatures were about 1.8 degrees F colder than they are today. Does that mean that we've warmed? Maybe not. Maybe we've normalized. But now we're at a point where we've got this extended period of time with no sunspots, and you can expect that is going to have an effect negatively on the temperature of the planet. It's not going to warm. It's going to cool. So you might say it's a normal cycle relative to the sun, and maybe it is. But you got to admit, between the years 1650 and 1715, there weren't a whole lot of cars on the road. There weren't a whole lot of jet planes going through the air burning kerosene. There were not any factories burning coal or burning natural gas. It wasn't out there, folks. It wasn't out there. That's what I'm trying to say. So when we think about this, when we really think about it, we put all the pieces together, it creates a kind of, oh, I don't know, an algorithm. That's an equation with multiple variables inputting it. And that algorithm, when it produces a result, it can sometimes be unpredictable. It's only when we control accurately all the variables in this that we get an output that can be predicted. So I doubt that we're controlling all the variables. However, when we think about it, every time you put that hose into the side of your car and you fill it up with gasoline, yeah, it hurts your pocketbook. But every single drop of that gasoline is going to turn into carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, which, by the way, is very difficult for our environment to take care of, and a variety of other chemicals, nitrous oxides and hydrocarbons. And every single time you sit at a stoplight or in traffic and you idle away, by the way, a recent study says that idling, just the idling, cost you $818 a year. That's a lot of money. That's a big screen TV. That's a new piece of furniture. That's an extra house payment. That's a lot of money to be idling away. And when you think about it, it doesn't take much. Look to the left and look to the right tomorrow morning as you go to work. How many lanes of cars are sitting there doing the same darn thing? Idling a paycheck, idling a house payment, idling a major home purchase, out that little 2-inch pipe or 1.5-inch pipe in the back of their car. That's crazy, people. That's just plain dumb. Why is it dumb? Because there's a better way. Because there's a smarter way to drive to work every day. You don't have to burn gasoline. I mean, if you want to, that's fine. If you want to drive 300 miles between Phillips, that's great. But you don't need to. And there's a smarter way. There's a way that's more in line, more conducive, more harmonious with the planet than the way we're doing it. That's all I'm trying to say. That's my climate change rant for the week. So think about it when you think about buying an electric vehicle. Check it out. And if you haven't visited Vision Motor Cars, just go there. We could use a few hundred thousand hits this week, so why don't you just go there and check it out. By the way, 20 minutes, we've got Brenda Williams coming on the program. She discovered, and I say discovered because this probably has always been there. However, I got to tell you, maybe some people inadvertently run into this. And they don't know how to describe it. They don't really know how to interpret it or how to assimilate it or how to interpret it for other people. But Brenda Williams has been able to do that. Because when she was sitting on her porch watching the wind in the trees, the movement of the birds and the animals and the clouds in the sky, she became aware of those subtle patterns of movement, like you have, like I have. Except that she got numbered sequences that began coming into her mind over and over again. And she finally took those sequences into a recording engineer, and that engineer created the sequences in audio form. Now, that is done in the studio these days on a computer. And one of the things they noticed on the computer was the shape of the wave. Although they couldn't hear the sequence, they could feel it, and so could everyone in the waiting room outside of the, quote, soundproof booth. So, if you want to know what that's like, you hang around 15 minutes, and you're going to hear it directly from Brenda Williams. I have never spoken to her, but I have a feeling we're going to have a heck of a conversation. And by the way, we have had less thunderstorms recently than in past years. Hold on one moment while I sip my wonderful ice cold. Doesn't sound too attractive if you're up in Boston area without electricity or heat tonight, but it's good anyway. Grapefruit juice. Hold on. Well, it wasn't a sip. It was a gulp, but it sure felt good. Electromagnetic fields beneath thunderstorms. You ever feel them? I have. I was on a mountain one time in Utah, and I was watching a storm come across the Utah Valley. I had my car radio on, and the car radio began making some interesting noise. It was kind of like a whine, like you're... Remember in the old cars when you could hear your alternator kind of whining when you were playing the AM radio? That's what it sounded like. Anyway, the storm got closer and closer, and one of the things that you should know is that mountains do attract lightning. They build up a charge on them. Of course, many times they're full of metal, so they're kind of like giant lightning rods. And as the clouds got closer and closer, you could feel the electricity building up on the mountain itself. You could feel it in your hair, on your skin. It was sort of like static electricity building up. You knew that mountain was going to get hit. Well, beneath thunderstorms, it increases to about 10,000 volts per meter because the storms and the earth act like the plates of a giant capacitor, and the air between the earth and the cloud is that air gap, that kind of dielectric, okay? Well, this ends up storing electrical energy from the surrounding environment. A wind of charged particles blows toward the developing storm. You felt that, right, as the wind's kind of blowing toward the storm that's coming toward you. pulling neutral air molecules along with the current, creating powerful updrafts that can occasionally rise all the way up into the stratosphere. Once the storm reaches a critical threshold, the stored energy is released. You've seen it. It's like a, I don't know how to describe it. It's beautiful to watch. Now, those of you that are scared of thunderstorms, I understand. But I'm fascinated by them. When I lived in Kentucky, I used to go out in the hay barns. Now, hay barns, as you know, don't have walls. They have a roof to keep the down rain off the hay itself. But you got to let the air get to the hay because the hay will, well, it'll get hot of its own accord, and it will spontaneously combust. So you got to let the air get to it and dry it out. But you got to keep the sun and the rain off it, so you put it in a hay barn. Well, before the hay's taken up in the early spring, you know, before you start cutting the first cuttings off the field, the hay barn's pretty much empty from the winter before. Now, there might be a few dozen bales, and it's kind of nice to pull those bales together in the middle of the hay barn, throw a convenient keg on it, and you can have a what we call a farm party. You just kind of, you know, have a party. You know, boys and girls getting down on the farm. And one of the favorite activities to do is to watch thunderstorms when you're out there. Now, if a tornado pops down out of that storm, of course, you don't want to be in the hay barn. You want to be in the ditch or in the storm cellar, but it's still kind of fun to watch. One day, we were watching these two clouds come together like giant behemoths. I mean, they were lashing out violent lightning at each other like two giants with these huge electrical brains, you know, just marched inexorably toward each other on the other side of the farm. And, of course, the thunder's rolling and the lightning lashing out across the sky, and it would just crackle so tightly you could just feel it. Well, these thunderstorms, these big ones that travel like that, they act like particle accelerators. They launch massive discharge upwards into space. We call them blue jets and sprites, red sprites. And they actually put off gamma radiation. That's true. We've measured it from space. Red sprites are these massive diffuse flashes above the active thunderstorms, coinciding with normal lightning strikes. They can be single events or multiple, with filaments above and below, often extending to altitudes close to 100 kilometers. Some of the largest sprites contain dozens of individual smaller sprites covering horizontal distances of up to 50 kilometers and a volume of 10,000 cubic kilometers. Now, the blue jets, they're distinct from sprites. Since they propagate upward in narrow cones that disappear at an altitude of about 50 kilometers, that's getting up toward the ionosphere, they are also more powerful because the electrical discharges are confined within a smaller spatial volume. They don't stretch out over 100 kilometers or so. They go straight up. Geophysicists are beginning to realize that sprites and jets are part of every moderate to large storm system and are an essential component in Earth's electrical circuit. Okay? It connects the Earth to its own atmosphere and to all the functions of the upper atmosphere. Electric universe theorists propose that what is observed on other planets within galaxies or in free space should be used as examples of what can occur on Earth, as opposed to using our planet to model the universe. We are part of a cosmic ecology that maintains a coherent physical aspect. So that aspect ought to apply here. So the European Space Agency, International Gamma Ray Astrophysics Laboratory, also called INTEGRAL, isn't it neat how these acronyms work out? I mean, they really spell real words. Anyway, it was launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in October of 2002. It is the first space-based observatory that can be used to simultaneously study objects in gamma ray, X-ray, and visible light. One of Integral's major finds was the observation in 2008 of an extreme X-ray source from the center of a remote galaxy cluster. X-ray emissions are far too intense to be generated from hot gas in the cluster, so shock waves must be rippling through the gas, the astrophysicists suggested. The temperature of gases in the cluster core was measured at about 100 million degrees Kelvin. Kelvin is 273 degrees off from Fahrenheit. Okay, so room temperature is several hundred degrees Kelvin. I'll just make it simple for you. Nobel laureate Hans Alfvén maintained that double layers are a unique celestial object and that intense X-ray and gamma ray resource or sources could be due to double layers shorting out and exploding. Double layers can accelerate charged particles up to enormous energies in a variety of frequencies, forming plasma beams. If the double layer breaks the circuit, the double layer may explode, drawing electricity from the entire circuit and discharging more energy than was contained in the double layer. Double layers dissipate when they accelerate particles and emit radiation, so they must be powered by external sources. Birkeland currents are theorized to transmit electric power over many light years through space, perhaps over thousands of light years. So they are most likely the power source for the extreme X-ray generator in Ophiuchus. I guess it's Ophiuchus. Why do they name them such weird names? Why don't they just call them Fred? So particle accelerators and thunderstorms and galaxy clusters are most likely manifestations of these Birkeland currents, pouring electricity into double layers. That's why these double layers appear to put out more energy than they collect. Sprites and jets exhibit filamentary structure, as does terrestrial lightning. You know, when you look up and you see a lightning bolt, you don't see them too much in the west. It more or less lights up the whole sky. But out here in the east, you can definitely see the filaments of a lightning strike. Streamers of plasma can be seen flowing through galaxy clusters, and in time, it may become evident that the scalable nature of the plasma universe reveals itself through electrical events, both large and small. I bet you didn't know that planets, solar systems, and galaxies were tied together with these Birkeland currents covering light years of space. We always thought it was dark matter adding the extra mass to the universe that allows galaxy clusters to revolve around each other. I mean, it's pretty easy to see that planets revolve around suns. It's even pretty easy to see that suns revolve around the center of a galaxy. Not too much of a brain jump there. And it's not too hard to realize that galaxies are going to revolve around each other in groups called clusters. But we still haven't figured out, other than these Birkeland currents and dark matter, how galaxy clusters revolve around each other. They're too far away for gravity to have effect from galaxy to galaxy. But these Birkeland currents, these electric currents, these attractions and repulsions, this flow of energy between the clusters could be why the universe appears the way that it does. Maybe dark matter doesn't exist at all. I think dark energy does, and I think it's only dark because we can't see it. Maybe it's super bright, as I've often said on this program. Perhaps it is even the subconscious of the universe. How about that? All right, 5 minutes. We've got Brenda Williams coming on. We're going to be calling her here in 5 minutes. We'll listen to a little music, and we'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. I'm Brooks Agnew. Don't go away. Here we go. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. We're in hour two. Our guest, we're still trying to get a hold of, Brenda Williams. She is the discoverer of the Triad Wave. So far, not been able to get a hold of her. So we will keep trying to get a message to her and see what we can do. Okay. Scientists maintain that we have planets, Earth-like planets, right next door. And they kind of put that in quotation marks because, I mean, after all, we could just pretty much see right next door, right? Not much going on other than an asteroid or two. And we'll talk a little bit about the latest asteroid that's supposed to make a very close pass. Might affect your cell phones, by the way, because it's going to pass closer than some of the geosynchronous satellites that we have. Astronomers reported this last Wednesday that the closest Earth-like planet may be a mere 13 light years away. Imagine that. That planet hasn't been found yet, of course, but there should be, based on the team's study of red dwarf stars. Oh, I thought I heard somebody say out there, Nibiru. Yes, you might be right. Anyway, we're talking about galactic neighborhood. Now we know the rate of occurrence of habitable planets around the most common stars in our galaxy, says the study's co-author, David Charbonneau. That rate implies that it will be significantly easier to search for life beyond the solar system than we previously thought. Small, cool red dwarfs are the most common stars in our galaxy. The number in our galaxy, about 75 billion. Well, that sort of increases the odds, doesn't it? Despite their dimness, these stars are good places to look for Earth-like planets. According to a release, red dwarfs make up about 3 out of every 4 stars of our galaxy for a total of, like I said, 75 billion. The signal, and by the way, these red dwarfs are fairly dense. They're not like a yellow sun like we have, so they can attract quite a bit of matter to them. The signal of a transiting planet is larger since the star itself is smaller. So an Earth-sized world blocks more of the star's disk. And since a planet has to orbit a cool star closer in order to be in the habitable zone, it's more likely to transit from our point of view. That is to say, the orbit has to be a little bit smaller. You got to be a little bit closer to the sun because the red suns give off less energy. They're kind of worn out suns. So in order to not be a frozen ball of ice, you got to get in there close to the fire. The Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics team estimates 6% of red dwarf stars have Earth-like planets. To qualify, the planet must be roughly the size of Earth and get as much light from its star as Earth does from the sun, so that, well, water will be in a liquid form. It's kind of rare if you think about it. If you get too close to the sun, well, the seas boil. And if you get too far away, they freeze, sort of like some of Saturn's moons. If you're too far away from the sun, it's pretty much a non-starter. Now, our elliptical orbit around the sun places the northern hemisphere of our planet a little closer to the sun than it does in the summertime. The southern hemisphere gets a little bit closer to the sun in the summertime than it does the wintertime. So its summers are going to be much more hot and much drier than those in the north. And that's just the way it goes. It could have been the other way around. So the northern hemisphere, we have a much more what we call temperate climate. The winters are not supposed to be that terrible, and the summers are also not supposed to be that terrible. Hence, if you look at Antarctica, you see that the Antarctic is growing in size because the winters are so cold that moisture can collect on the ice caps of Antarctica and stay much longer. Likewise, the summers in the south are much more intense than they are in the north because we are a little bit closer to the sun at that time. It's kind of nice to be pointing away from it during that period. That's why our North American and European winters are just not that devastating. The rate of the occurrence of these planets should simplify the search for extraterrestrial life. Yeah, like that is what they're really after doing. By the way, I just saw the movie Battleship. And hats off. You know, it's not really what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be kind of a Transformers throwback. It wasn't, not at all. It had a pretty good storyline. Basically, what happens is the space antenna at Hawaii teams up with a satellite at a specific time. They beam a high-energy signal up to the satellite. The satellite takes that signal, relays it out into space, and just boom, it goes out into deep space. Well, as our luck would have it, and fortunately for the director, this was the case, a passerby of five or six alien ships happened to pick that signal up, trace the direction of it, and they followed it right back here to Earth. When they arrived, they landed in the sea just around the Hawaiian Islands. Just about the same time that Liam Neeson, Admiral of the Navy at the time in the movie, is going to have some exercises between the American and the Japanese navies. And sure enough, the Navy is kind of spread out to kind of do the little Navy thing out there on the water. And the aliens land, they dome off a section of the ocean deep down into the sea and several hundred thousand feet up above. With a force field, and they seal it off and try to establish communications on the Hawaiian Islands. Of course, the star of the movie, the same one that starred in John Carter, does a pretty good job of fighting them off, and sure enough, with a old World War II battleship, the Missouri, they end up whipping the aliens, and they don't get their signal off to their deep space race, telling them, hey, we have a juicy one here. Come on down to Wide Track Down because we've got some cheap chores for you. Anyway, the aliens are defeated. Pretty good movie. I enjoyed it. So when we think about NASA, JPL, and those down at the folks down at Wars R Us searching for extraterrestrial life, I think we're trying seriously in an official way to say, I see you, but you can't see me. I don't think it's going to work out so good. Anyway, the authors of the study say locating nearby Earth-like worlds may require a dedicated small space telescope or a large network of ground-based telescopes. You don't need an Earth clone to have life, by the way, says Harvard astronomer and lead author Courtney Dressing. The three habitable zone planetary candidates identified in the study are Kepler Object of Interest, that's also got an acronym, KOI, 1422.02, which is a 90% planet the size of Earth, in a 20-day orbit. That's pretty tight around a red dwarf, don't you think? A 20-day year. And also KOI 2626.01. Ah, there's a good candidate. 1.4 times the size of Earth in a 38-day orbit. And there's one more. And that's KOI 854.01. Where are you from? I'm from 854.01. All right. 1.7 times the size of Earth in a 56-day orbit. All three are located about 300 to 600 light years away and orbit stars with temperatures between 5,700 and 5,900 degrees Fahrenheit. Our sun's temperature, by the way, is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Not all that hot. It's a medium-sized sun. It's a medium main sequence sun. And these results will be published in the Astrophysical Journal. But you got to hear about it first right here on X-Squared Radio, so that's cool. Now, I've got a currency war update. And I've got a drone war update tonight. And I think you're going to like both of them. Both of them are real eye-openers. We've got a message out to Brenda Williams. She's the one that discovered the triad wave. My good friend Stephanie Paulus, who was on the program a couple of weeks ago, is the one that gave me the heads up. So I've got a message out to her to try to reach Brenda down at the Five Guys restaurant or wherever she might happen to be tonight to see if we can raise her. Because we kind of like to talk to her tonight. All right, currency wars. By the way, those of you that listen to this program, we don't go into conspiracy theories or into ghosts too much. Hold on a second. Wow, that grapefruit juice. Particularly refreshing tonight. We try to approach these from almost a mathematical point of view because it's such a complex algorithm. That is to say, we have inputs that are uncontrolled, multiple inputs to the same complex equation that are uncontrolled. And so it becomes fascinating to watch because on the one hand, we see the Federal Reserve printing about $40 to $80 billion a month to try to stabilize the loss of the value of the dollar, which you would think would have quite the opposite effect since you're printing more money or actually creating inflation. But the Federal Reserve knows no other way but to inflate the money supply in order to keep cash in the system since it's not being earned because, well, there aren't enough taxpayers. So you have to make up the money by printing more so the government has more to spend. Because the government, well, the federal government, the United States government, is competing with its own people for the available funds in the banks. Normally, the banks meet the credit needs of the community. That is to say, businesses have to buy nuts and bolts and paint and boxes and stuff like that, fuel, in order to make the products, to sell the products to a waiting public who's trying to buy those products. And the fact that the people are working at the factories that make that product means they earn enough wage to be able to buy the product. Well, now you see how complex the economy gets. Unfortunately, the administration is borrowing every single dollar that's available in the banks. So there's nothing left for industry. There's nothing left for manufacturers and groceries and factories and mills and mines. There's nothing left for them to borrow. So if they don't have the money to borrow, they can't buy the inventory to build the product that they have the demand for. If they don't sell any product, they can't make any money. If they don't make any money, they got to lay everybody off. And now you see how complex the problem is going the other way. So it becomes fascinating to this program. Fascinating because the solution is so darn simple. It's so simple. And yet, because of the easiness of the way, many did perish. What? It's from the Bible. It's from the Bible, you know, when they were traveling, the Jews were traveling in the desert and they became bit by the serpents. You remember the poisonous serpents? Moses would hold his staff up and say, look upon the staff and you'll be healed. Well, some of the people looked and they were healed. Yeah, okay, that's cool. But most people are pretty smart. I mean, they think they are. So they tell Moses, no, it can't be that simple. I can't just look on the staff and be healed. Are you crazy? I've been bit by a snake. Come on, suck the poison out, will you? And they died. Because of the easiness of the way, many did perish. Well, that's what's happening right now. The administration believes that the way out is to spend, baby, spend every penny you can get your hands on. And if there's not enough, no problem. Call up the folks down at the Fed and have them run the presses. Daddy needs a new pair of shoes. We got to take another 35-day, $4 million vacation. Come on, let's get some money in here. I mean, wouldn't that be great if you had a press, you know, down in the lodge in your neighborhood? You got a little low on money, you know. You know the house payment's coming due. You have 12 bucks in the bank. No problem. We'll go down to Jeffrey's house. He'll print us some money. We'll take it to the bank. No problem. Pay the bill. That's what it's like. So we have currency wars going on right now. Now, one of the other reasons when you go to the bank, you try to borrow money, and the bank says, fill out this application, talk to our loan officer, let us check your credit, and we'll do a background check on you and check your height and your race, and then we'll go to the loan committee, and I'm so sorry. We really, you know, you need to just, you know, I'm sorry, we can't loan you the money. Have you tried that lately? Have you gone down to a franchise car dealership? A franchise car, like Dodge, Toyota, Kia, Hyundai, new cars. Go to a new car franchise, try to buy a car. You know what they say? Uh-uh. You don't have at least a 720, 730 credit score, you're not buying a car. What do you mean? What does the credit score mean? Don't ask me. I don't know. What do you think? I'm a mathematician? Listen, people, I am a mathematician, and I can't understand how they do the credit score. You go down to buy a new car. They used to look at your credit and say, oh, I see you're a homeowner. I see you've been in the same home for 5 years. That's 60. 5 times 12, you know, it's 60. 60 payments, never missed one. Pretty good. I see you've owned a car before this. Ah, 5 years old. 60 payments, never missed a payment. Not bad. By the way, I see this. You had a 30-day late on your pennies card. What's all that about? I mean, it was like a $15 payment. Why did you miss that? Oh, well, yeah. I mean, that could happen to anybody. Come on. Ah, exactly. Florida vacation, forgot about it. You got back. No problem. Put the 15 bucks in the mail. No problem. We'll sell you a car. Doesn't happen that way anymore. Now what happens is the credit bureaus, you know, Experian, Equifax, TRW, what they do is a complex calculation, and they come up with a score, a number, you know, 550, 650, 750, 850. They go by that number. I'm sorry, we can't sell you a car if you don't have a 730 or above credit score. I don't care if you never missed a house payment. I don't care if you never missed a car payment. I don't care if you got sick for a summer and you had some doctor bills build up and it took you about 6 months to pay them off. We don't care about that. You're not buying a car. So where do you have to go for a car? Oh, you have to go to a used car lot. Now, for those of you that have a credit score, oh, let's say between 600 and 700, well, we have a solution for you. No. It's not bank financing. They're not for you. You're going to have to go through a finance company. Yeah, finance companies use a different form of interest. It's called the rule of 78s. Now, I can't draw the equation for you here on the radio, but suffice it to say that the rule of 78s means that you pay all of your interest up front. So if you were to take out a three-year loan for $1,000 from a finance company and you made the payments every single month, let's say the payments were $50 a month, $60 a month. You made $60 a month payments for 1 year. How much would you still owe? Now, I don't expect you to be able to do it in your head. But if you took out a three-year loan in a finance company and made 1 year of payments at $60 a month, and let's say the original balance was $1,000, that's what you actually borrowed, your balance would still be $1,000. I know. Isn't that weird? Like, wait a minute. I paid $720 in a year, and I still owe $1,000? Yes, it's true. because they're charging you 29% interest, but all the interest is front-loaded. That means you pay all the interest in the first year and a half. You don't even start paying on the principal until you've been making payments for a year and a half. Now, that's the car loan for you, right? That's the car loan for you. Why did you go to that lot in the first place? Oh, yeah, you went to the franchise because they advertised 0% interest. You didn't read the small print, for qualified buyers only. Now, let's suppose you have a credit score between 500 and 600. Sorry, finance company's not for you. You have to go the next level down to a buy here, pay here lot. What is that? Oh, come on. 67% of America falls in this range. 67% of America has to buy at a buy here, pay here lot. That means that you go down and you buy a $5,000 car, but you have to make your payments weekly. And there's a GPS locator on your car. If you stop paying your payments, you miss a week's payment, they turn your car off. It won't go. Yeah, a little $300 option they put on the car when you buy it because they don't trust you. Well, you think to yourself, wait a minute. I have a job. I'm a taxpaying American. I have an apartment. I have a home. I've owned cars before. I should be able to do this. Yes, you should. Yes, you should. But the credit community has decided to do something else with your money. The credit community has decided not to loan the money out that you have deposited in their bank to you or to anybody else. What they do with the money, as soon as the tumbler closes and the front door lock, that money goes on the money market. It goes into the currency wars. What does that mean? Well, that means that all those dollars that you have in the bank, they get sold. And they buy things like yen because the yen has more value than the dollar. And it may trade back and forth between euros and yen and rupees and around it goes. How many times? Oh, buddy, you think day traders are active? Not even close. They have computers that make these trades. And the computers move so fast, you can't believe it. They borrow technology from NASA, super switchers that link computers together and make the computers move so fast that these traders can actually make hundreds of micro trades a month. Each one of these trades, they'll make a tenth of a percent or 0.15%, or sometimes if they're really lucky, 1%. But they do it 30, 40, 50 solid times a month, their whole inventory turns over. That means of the 21 days a month that that bank is open, they're taking your money and they're trading it. Hold on 1 second while I write a note here. Just take a pause. Okay, I am going to skip the currency wars right for the moment because we have found Brenda Williams. Let's bring Brenda on now. I've given you the introduction. Brenda is, as I told you, the discoverer of the triad wave. We're going to find out what that is, why that affects people the way that it does. I've been listening to her music all day, and I got to tell you, it's pulled me out of a general funk, and I've enjoyed it immensely.
Oh, welcome. Hi. this is kind of a surprise.
That's all right. We have a mutual friend, Stephanie Paulus.
Yes, we do. She had told me earlier about your show, and I just didn't know it was tonight. So thank you.
Well,
let me see. What can I tell you about the wave? Well, and I will refer to it as the wave.
Ask you a question, because I have done a lot of old frequency studies of my own in the oil and gas industry, and one of the things that I noticed on a spectrometer were these wave shapes that would identify themselves with water, natural gas, oil, things like that. So I'm familiar with wave shapes and what they mean, but I don't know really how to explain them to the average person. You've figured out how to do that. You figured out how to not only recognize it, but use it. So how did you discover it?
Now you're getting, how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go? I was diagnosed in 1990 with terminal cancer. And so part of my recovery process when I determined not to take therapy was sitting outside on my deck, and I began to notice different patterns and rhythms. And very shortly into that, I began to understand differences in how my body responded to different stimuli. My sensory system began to come online in a little bit different way. And so the technology, the sine wave series, actually started as a series of numbers with very specific timing intervals. And I don't have a background in this, so I didn't exactly know what to do with it. So I took it into a recording studio, to a friend's recording studio, and asked him if he could make me a CD. He very quickly told me that it's infrasound, so it is below the level of human hearing. Works very similarly as to when you're in the water with dolphins, and you're receiving sonar. You're receiving frequencies from their sound, and so it works very similar to that, and has a similar effect in one segment with regard to how the body functions and how the body receives it. The technology itself is done in three separate segments or wave sequences. It is a sine wave series, and that is because it's the simplest. It is also the one that is most received, particularly in the pineal gland. So we're looking at how does the body recognize different stimuli, and then what does it do with it? So 20 years later, I have been able to understand how the body responds and where the routing went awry, so that we do not define or determine what we're seeing and experiencing in an unentrained way. So the wave was designed to bring that fully online. The human form was designed in an autonomic way to work very much like the elephants when they know how to get away from the tsunami, and instead, as human beings, we stand there and wait till we can see it. If you can see it, you can't run fast enough. So it's just bringing that sensory system back online, and that's the physiological aspects of it. It also works in other models and in other ways, but primarily for me, it started out as a way to understand how my body actually worked, how it translated what it was seeing, hearing, and experiencing, and how to get back to an original blueprint design of how it could be self-regulating.
When I think about this, I think that our DNA is all over this planet. It's in every plant, every animal. It's scattered everywhere. So it's obviously an engineered molecule, and it makes up our DNA and our gene structure. And we're made with a bunch of junk DNA that we're still trying to figure out. And we're pretty smart fellas when it comes to molecular biology and what things do. Lord knows we can take jellyfish and cabbage, and we can make corn grow better and resist Roundup already. But I think that there's some instinctive resonance that goes with the molecular biology that actually makes up the what I call the biological transducer, which is the human body. It's the thing that kind of holds our soul on this planet. And I think a lot of us kind of get lost. We think that we're this bag of water that walks around on this planet and, you know, has pimples and has a little bit of pudge sticking out over your belt.
That's really?
That's not the person we are. We're this giant, flying, leaping spirit, you know. But What's missing, I think, is that this biological transducer only has so many senses and they're kind of limited in the bandwidth that they can perceive. But we have other senses like the pineal gland, as you say, that can pick up this sub-aural frequency. And it seems to be, at least from what I can tell by how you lace it into the music or video that you play, it seems to be responsible for, I'm going to use the word rewiring, sort of rewires the energy body so that it will heal itself. Is that pretty close?
Well, it actually goes a little deeper than that. What you're working with within the sequencing of the three different sequences of the wave section, you know, are looking at working with the primary controlling mechanisms within the physical form. The form is not just a water body that gets us around. It was intricately created. You know, we don't have to think when we breathe. We don't have to think when our heart beats. Well, we also were designed to not have to think with our sensory system, and we've relegated that to being nothing. So what happened is it's more about the routing of information through the body. When a signal comes in, something happens, it runs through the hypothalamus. I call it the hypothalamic axis. You're looking at the hypothalamus, which is the master control center of the physical form itself. It's going through the pineal gland, which is your access to your higher cognitive abilities, and your pituitary gland, which regulates hormones. So those are the three primary functions that the wave in a physiological way works with. Well, what happens when something comes in? We get information, it comes and it starts its little route. It's designed to come into the prefrontal cortex, focus and discernment. But what happens is it gets stuck in the limbic system, where we define in a paradox. Not only that, it's a double paradox. We got good and bad, and we've got our pleasure center. So we've got a lot of confusion that's defined emotionally based on past trauma. So if we, as a person receiving some comment from someone, and we translate it in through that limbic system, it's translated with emotion and based on experience. That signal based on emotion goes back into the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus says, but wait a minute, I don't know how to send that message to the cellular system to regulate, so you're just going to have to get sick because we don't have communication going. So the cosmic understanding, or our higher expression that wants to stay housed in our form, can't, because the form is constantly in inner conflict. So how do we change that perceptual reality? And it's actually quite simple, and that's what makes it so, you know, people go, well, that's just too easy, so we don't want to do that. And it's like, well, no, it's quite simple, actually, when you apply and work with it and see the simplicity of it. It's more of a platform that brings us into resonance with the planet herself. The first segment works with bringing us into movement and resonance with the planet, adjusting to her cycle, not grounding to her. We don't want to stick anything in her. We want to ride her like a surfboard, because her consciousness and her sensory system is very much like ours. So we're looking at that. The second segment then begins to work with how we gather in that multidimensional understanding of who we are. And then the third segment deals with how we recreate our perceptual reality. What is our perceptual threshold? How much does it take to get our attention? Can we hear the whisper, or do we have to get run over by the Amtrak train?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everyone that I know that, you know, has some illness, and I've known quite a few people even close to me that had cancer, they have... I'm going to say a similar trait, in the sense that they know they're sick. They say they don't want to be sick, and yet everything they do in their life attracts the sickness to them. Does that make sense?
That's when thoughts, words, and actions are not consistent and congruent. And a lot of what we work with when we bring people into these group calls, or we do a you know, person-to-person or groups or whatever, is to first of all give them two little exercises to do. That first, you know, it's a breath. It's a real simple breath, but it's sort of like your mother telling you, when I was a little girl, my granny used to always say, now, Brenda Jane, you better think before you say anything, because I had a little smart mouth. And she would always tell me to count to 10 before I opened my mouth to respond to anything that was said so I wouldn't get a spanking. And so it's similar to that. What we're doing is signaling the brain to say, you know, you're on the wrong track and I'm going to get your attention because I want to show you another way to do this. And the other part is that we're making an electromagnetic connection to that spark of who we are that resides within our physical form itself. And those are quite simple, so they're very simple things that can move into mainstream environments with very little effort. It's also something that every human being on the planet has the ability to do for themselves right away. You don't have to go to school, you don't have to, you know, take a course, you don't have to read a book. You just need to do this. And that starts that process of the body beginning to understand what it was actually created to do. And once that happens, then we begin to build on it, because there are lots of really great tools and techniques out there. However, what we've not been able to keep moving with is sustainability, because we either get bored with it, we get tired of it, something distracts us and we don't continue, we don't maintain it. So what this does is to prepare the form itself, the body communication network, to begin to accept what you're working with to go through that healing process or that change of perception. And it's sort of like the preparation. You're going to do a little preparation here, and once you begin to work with that consistently, it reestablishes that as the autonomic function that it was designed to be in the first place. So we're just bringing what we already know online in a way to create a sustainable platform for us to do whatever it is we're doing, healing ourselves or, you know, working with someone, working on a job, reaching maximum potential all the time.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we notice in business, and I'm, you know, been not human resource management, but I've certainly had a lot of people work for me over the years in plants and factories. And one of the things we notice that sometimes we hire someone, whether they're a line worker or an engineer, or an office worker, a programmer, whatever, and they're not, you know, particularly brilliant, not really, you know, knocking everything out of the park or working themselves to death or coming early and leaving late. But one thing we notice is everywhere we put this person, things improve. Things get better. We have less tardiness. We have less absences. We have less scrap. We have more production. We have less machine downtime just because that person's there. And we've never been able to put our finger on it. Over the years, we just simply call it the X factor. We just say that that's one of our X factors, and doesn't matter where we put them, things will improve. It could be because they've tapped into this resonance, this harmony.
What they're doing is maintaining their personal field of existence in a resonant way, and when they move and connect to other fields, whether it's a person next to them, they've established a group field within the corporation or the division itself, the room itself, they learn to move in those fields without creating what we refer to as ripples. And that's part of what we work with, is once you understand the mechanics of these simple, three little simple things, because it's innately encoded in your DNA to start with, it's how we were created. So once we remember that by defining it ourselves, so when we do these classes or we do these groups, what we're doing is providing an example, an experience, and then we're listening to interactive dialogue as you describe it to yourself. Once you verbally give form to it in your own vibrational language, you don't ever forget it. And it ultimately becomes part of who you are. And I think the people that have been able to find that just, you know, lots of times trauma does that. It seems like if someone's gone through a devastating illness and came through the, you know, came through it, they change the way they perceive reality. You also lose fear. You know, once you've been through, what's there to be afraid of? What's the worst thing that can happen?
That's true.
Well, if you've been on the other side, there are no worse things. So you lose that fear factor, and there's an element of trust. And then you begin to understand that it's much nicer to be in a resonant field than to be in inner conflict. And if we can perpetuate that through the planet by bringing that innate quality within the human population, we won't have the mess we're in right now, because what we resist persists, so we're keep on pushing to say, well, this is right and this is wrong. Well, they're both true, because remember, we're translating through a paradoxical system within our limbic system. Once that stops, the body moves itself well, and those resonant fields begin to vibrationally move up in understanding, and we stop some of the madness that we're in.
Well, let's see if we can take this on three different levels then, because I'm seeing this form in my mind now. We have an individual training that's going on. We're learning to voice things. We're learning to recognize things that we once knew, we forgot maybe before this life or the life before that, and now we're going to remember it because it's been rediscovered, and we've encapsulated it and packaged it, and we're going to deliver it to you. So that happens. Then we have the group change, which occurs when this individual who's now remembered interacts with others, and their fields begin to entrain, and they begin to feel alive. And once groups happen, then nations can happen, and then maybe planets. And I guess the idea is to spread it all over the place instead of starting it out in one place in the Midwest. Start it all over the planet at one time. And then, maybe then, we don't hear on the news of hundreds of thousands of people chanting in the streets, "Death to America," because you're not going to have those wishes on your heart any longer.
We don't understand, I think, as a population, that we might say, "I want peace." We might go out and hold up a peace sign, but our thought, which is transmitted on a sine wave, is saying, "I really would just like to just stomp my neighbor down in the ground because he keeps throwing trash in my yard.
I wish they'd be like me, darn it."
Yeah, thoughts, words, and actions are disharmonic, discordant. So what we don't understand yet, as normally, is that it has to come into resonance. It does. We have to have them all three matching, and we were created to have them all three matching. It doesn't mean everything's going to be all sugar and, you know, whipped cream. It does mean, though, that we're going to have the capability of making choices in a different way. And when we make choices void of the emotional push, then what happens is we make better choices, which means we have less and less confusion, which means we have less and less chaos. That's just the normal sequencing. Are the off planets, are the universal systems that are so abundantly alive and well out there watching? Of course. Are they affected exponentially by what happens here? Of course. Are they doing what they can to assist in what's taking place? Of course. How do we work with that now, and how do we take advantage of the massive support that we have right now to make this statement in a way that every level of understanding on the planet can begin to work with it? It's not working with elite groups that, you know, let me go in where people are of like mind. Well, just put me in the middle of a bunch of people that are not of like mind, because that's when we're going to have resolution. We've got to learn to come together and play nice in the playground together, which means we've got to understand, first of all, how to be resonant within our own field, and then how to be able to communicate with one another without the emotional charge. And that's a lot of what the wave was designed to do for this particular period of time that we're in. It was designed for this time. Ages ago, I was given an instruction to journal everything. So for 20-some years, since 1990, every day has been very explicitly journaled about what this process was like, who was involved, how did it happen, what are the consequences of it, how can we keep it simple, how can we bring this into hospitals, into schools, into prisons, into all of those environments. And a lot of the models have already been in place. I was doing this back in the 90s, and it was way ahead of its time, so I just stopped and got very quiet. And within the last year, it has come fully back online. And so I think that people are beginning to understand now that we do have a solution. And what we have to do is each of us who have pieces of this puzzle have to begin to communicate with one another. And that's what's happening now, which is, I think, very exciting.
Sure, sure it is. Now, tell us a little bit about the equipment of the Triad Wave. Now, I didn't meet with anybody. I didn't go to a group. I just went to your website.
Which is about to be changed. We've got a lot more information that's going to go up on it that I'm in process. In fact, it's all over my little room now with dry erase board sticky notes everywhere. But
All I did was listen to the audio. I was doing show prep today, and I was doing some research papers for my company, trying to do some financial projections, which can be quite stressful because the spreadsheets all get linked together and you kind of have to get into it and not get out of it until it's done. But I put my headphones on and I just kept clicking on the different audio things that you have on your website, which is what, again, share that with our listeners?
Sure. www.earthproject777.com.
There you go. I went there and I just started listening. There's no words, there's no singing, it's just like mood music, atmospheric music, different things like that. But after about 3 hours of listening to that, I felt pretty good. I wasn't stressed out at all. I said, well, you know, the music was soothing, but after a while I began to perceive that there was something underneath the music that I couldn't hear, but seemed to be having a very calming effect. What is that?
That's actually the wave itself. It's a subacoustic series, sine wave series, that is embedded underneath. There is no subliminal information at all, and there's nothing that is out of the natural progression of the physical form itself and life. You know what the golden mean is? I'm sure you understand, you know, the spiral and all of that. It's the sequencing of life, seashells, all of that. Well, it's the same thing, and what happens with the wave is that anything that is out of resonance with the absolute perfection of the sequencing of life, the natural flow of life, it creates sort of like a little Mori pattern, M-O-I-R-E. It's a French word that defines sort of a tweedy fabric, but it just kind of gets caught in it, and so it neutralizes anything that's not of your highest expression. And we learned that over the years. It's been quite an experience in itself. But what we do is any kind of audio, visual, or live productions, you know, you could embed it underneath your broadcast. So what we do, there's a specific, it's very, you know, it's intricate how you do it, but it's doable. And so that's what we do. So we're continually bringing on new music. I've got some new to come up. I've got a new series of crystal bowls that are really pretty, and I'm not a crystal bowl, you know, fanatic, but this one is exceptionally beautiful. And the crystal clear series that Steve Scudler did in Colorado was the first one we worked with, and he has a new one out now too. So a lot of those are getting ready to go up to upload onto the website. So people can actually hear, you can actually purchase these if you go to their website. Basically, the website is designed to do several things. One of them is to give people an understanding of the strangeness of the Earth Project, what it was designed to do specifically, and the next piece of it is getting ready to go up, to give you the information on the technology itself, what it was designed to do, how it works, how you can become involved in it. And the next, the piece that's getting ready to go up is referencing a nonprofit that I had back in the 90s when I was actually doing this live, and it's called Quiet Miracles. And the Quiet Miracles are the things that are very subtle that happen in our lives that we don't notice in our busyness. And what the Triad Wave assists us in doing is bringing that sensory system so keenly back online as it was designed that we don't miss the whispers anymore. So a lot of what this is just to give you tools that you can use to establish and to support you as you are beginning to work with this. People can hear it, or it's floating through the ionosphere all the time. So, I mean, the wave is inside your own DNA and transmitting from your heart. But what happens is, in order to effectively utilize it and become proficient at it, you have to engage it, which means you have to consciously participate. And so that's the big, you know, thing right now, is that we're working to make that available and have that opportunity for people to be able to experience the simplicity of the foundational pieces, so that when they work with other techniques or technologies or anything, they've got the physical support to integrate it, to assimilate it and decode it, and then be able to use it more efficiently.
That sounds outstanding. I love the way not only the technology is applied, but the infrastructure that you've put together almost in an inspired way to create a self-replicating organization that can go throughout the world and really make a change. It can really change the world.
You know, when I remember in the early days, that was always what I would hear in my head, and I would just go, "Really? I'm from the middle of North Carolina, and excuse me, I do not have a background in any of this, and you're telling me that this is going to change the world." And yes, one by one, because our human form is so intricate in how it works. And if we understand, you know, the simplicity of how we can do something so simple as become aware of how it's receiving and transmitting information.
Well, one of the things...
Everything else is a piece of cake.
But one of the things that we notice a lot, and in the sense that we have a Food and Drug Administration, they require drug companies and treatment companies to go through all kinds of testing. And one of those testing, if they get there, is called clinicals. And what they do is they create a set of trials where they get some volunteers who will come in and volunteer to take drugs. Now, some of the group will be given a placebo, and some will be given the drug. A placebo is a fake, a sugar pill, a lookalike.
Uh-huh.
You mentally think you're taking the drug, but you're not. Uh-huh. And what's noticed repeatedly when they do these trials is that... a remarkable number, a very statistically significant number of the placebo people actually realize the benefits of the drug. That is to say, they're healed, their headache goes away, you know, inflammation stops, swelling goes down, things like that. They can't explain that. Of course, they promptly remove those people from the trial that actually were cured by the placebo, because that's not what they're all about anyway. Me, I'm doubling up on my placebos. I can tell you that right now.
Me too. You know, I every time I hear about one of those, I was doing back in the 90s, I did a series of talks at Duke Mind Body Study Group, and they had me one day in this big, you know, white coat arena. You know, they were up on those little bleacher looking things in the auditorium, and I was being questioned, you know, about, well, what kind of clinical trials have you been involved in? And I just looked at him and I said, "When do you want to start?" You know, you're Duke. I'm a single person with a concept that we are seeing results from, but why would anybody want to go into a blind study? First of all, you wouldn't have to be concerned about this, because I'm not giving you drugs, and everyone would have the same experience. they define it differently, but everyone has the same experience because we're working with the mechanical process of how the body functions and how it assimilates and translates information and then sends it through the cellular system to do what it needs to do. So if our own doubt or our own paradox within, you know, well, this can't possibly work, is not in charge, then it's going to work. But if that's in charge, it doesn't matter what you're doing if you have doubt and you don't trust. So there again, I'm taking this and I believe it's going to work, but you've got that little doubt back there in the back of your mind, and people don't understand how powerful that is.
Well,
yes, we have the capability of creating our own reality at any moment. And that's a big stretch for people to ever even get close to grasping that concept.
Well, it is. It is.
It's the truth.
But the struggle occurs, Brenda, because the conscious mind, that's the one that, you know, we make our decisions whether we're going to overeat or not, or how hard we're going to work, or who we're going to love, and all that stuff. The conscious mind, we think it's in control, and generally it is. But the subconscious mind, the one that runs all the systems of the body, the one that actually feels and accumulates and banks that stress that you're applied to every day, that's the one that's really in charge. That's the one that's interlinked between all the cell walls of every molecule in your body and resonates with the energy of your spirit. That's the energy that this triad wave seems to reach.
Yes, now, and it's saying, you're not talking a language that I can transmit through your cells, so I'm just going to let you have it your way.
Exactly, because it's not...
And it does. And, you know, you tell that story and people get it because they begin to understand. It's not looking at a lot of technical stuff. It's saying you have to have some practical application. You have to have a practical application of this. But look how simple this is. Boom, boom, boom. I mean, we're doing this on the phone. I did not believe that we would be able to do group calls on the phone. I said, we can't possibly teach this on the phone. Well, we can. We can do the first 3 weeks. We can get you through what we call the reset breath and quiet touch, which are the mechanical processes. We can get you through understanding what your 18-inch, we call it the 18-inch personal field of existence, because if you put your arms out in front of you and just barely touch your fingertips like you're holding a big basketball or, I mean, a big beach ball, and then consider that tube runs all the way around you, that is your personal field of existence. And it's very simple to get people to understand what that is in terms of how their sensory relates to it. So we found out very quickly we could do that in, you know, boom, 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 phone calls. What we couldn't do is the next step when you begin to start merging fields and understanding what it's like when your personal field actually touches another field of existence, and what is that signature, and can you recognize your group signature even when you're not in the group, because we have the capability of being able to do that. So as we begin to expand the experience of the fields, what we're doing is getting people to be more aware of our connectivity to everything that exists on the planet.
Exactly.
And it's such a simple process because it's done specifically by just here's the exercise. Now let's talk about it.
You know, I can see because it's so simple, it could also be a little frustrating, and I'll just relate back to the placebo group. I said a statistical number of the placebo group were healed, but there were others in the placebo group that weren't healed. In fact, there were others in the drug group that weren't healed.
Yes.
Something about those people refusing to heal, and I hate to use that word because when you talk to people who are ill and you say, you know, you're really refusing to get well, they just are furious at you because, you know, they swear that they're not making themselves sick, that they don't want to be sick. But everything they do, every bit of energy that they resonate, in fact, most of their waking hours, they're doing things, thinking things, and feeling things that make themselves sick.
Yes. My sense around that and that's a question that comes up frequently. And first of all, within the concept of the triad wave, it does not override your own conscious application to have your experience any way you want it. It will not override and make you get well or make you see life differently.
Darn.
It opens the pathway for you to understand how to make choices differently. The next step of that is that I think that there, you know, when I made the comment that we can either hear the whisper or we can get hit by the Amtrak train,
mm-hmm.
we call that your perceptual threshold. How much are you going to have to experience to get the aha from it? Because that's what we're here to, you know, we're all here learning how to move through our experience and have a different understanding of who we are as human beings, as cosmic beings, as, you know, divine beings, whatever word you want to put around it. So we're not, you know, there are certain things that we have set in motion that we just can't seem to grasp yet. So it's not going to do it for you. It's going to always open the possibility at every moment for you to make another choice. So some people, you know, what's in it? What, you know, what are you getting out of it? You know, well, maybe I can address my own personal experience. When I was diagnosed with cancer, I was so overwhelmed with responsibilities, obligations, things that didn't feel resonant with who I knew at the core of my being I was. I needed a break, and that was my break. So my gift ultimately in that diagnosis was that it gave me the opportunity for everybody to step back and allow me to understand and discover who I really was and what I was, you know, what I was about, instead of living someone else's version of my reality, which is what I had spent most of my life doing.
Sure, sure. Well, so, you know, it's always
we can't override. We don't have permission to override your experience, and not everybody will get it at the same time, and that's okay.
Well, what's always fascinated me about this, you call it the doubt or the wonder or the, hey, wait a minute, how can that work? Where are the clinicians and the doctors when these placebo healings do take place? And these people are diagnosed with these problems, whether it's lupus or MS or whatever they're treating. Where are the clinicians and doctors following the people out of that room that were healed with the placebo, asking the question, hey, wait a minute. What happened? You took a sugar pill and yet you're cured. Why aren't they studying those people?
Well, I think because it's not what they're trained to do, and I can speak from my experience with a lot of physicians, and in fact, I'm working on some projects now with some doctors. So there is a movement, and there is a curiosity now, because they're beginning to understand that what they're doing isn't working. And so there are many, you know, we do hear about all the ones that aren't on the bandwagon, that are, you know, paid by big bucks to do not much, and there are plenty of those around, but there are also some really very skilled and very wise physicians who are looking at it differently and beginning to explore what those possibilities might be. Are they following the placebos? There's some who are doing that. There are some who are asking the questions now, well, how did you do that? How did that happen? The downside of following someone who just recovered from, you know, this miraculous disease process is that they don't have an explanation. They can't tell you what happened.
Exactly.
So part of what happened in the 20 years here that I, you know, put this together is that we've been able to, you know, I kind of became a guinea pig. I had to learn how to sense movement. I had to learn how to sense where things weren't working or where the information stopped moving in my body to give the result that we were wanting. And I think that now when I'm able to speak with people, what we can do is to give them that same capability of being able to sense what's going on, so that they now can have the language to begin to talk about it. We don't have that yet as a collective. So, you know, somebody might want to know what, you know, for me, I was in a hospice and died. And it's like, well, what happened? Well, I could only tell you what I remembered, which was minimal, until I started writing the book. And I said, you know, I need to really know what happened. I didn't want to know because it was very traumatic, and I didn't want to know any of the details. In fact, I found some old photographs that were made, and I looked, and I'm going, I don't even recognize who that person was.
Exactly.
But what I understood when I began to have to go back into it and work with it and actually tell the story, what I began to understand was that in order to come back and talk about it, I had to learn the language to speak about it. I had to be willing to step out of the box and say, look, you may think I'm crazy because of what I'm telling you, but here's what I know is truth. And up until just about 4 months ago, the stuff that's even on the website, there wasn't a person on the planet that knew about it.
Exactly.
So this is sort of one of those things that it's how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go? Because we look at things as being so mysterious and so impossible, and yet you reach a point that you understand that we live in a field of unlimited possibilities, and all things are possible. We are the ones that limit it, and now we understand how we do it. So if we know how we do it, then we know how to share how we can undo it.
Well, so you're talking to a physicist
about
possibilities. Could you stay for another 40, 50 minutes?
Sure, I don't have an off button.
All right, let's take a quick break, get something to drink. We're going to listen to a little music and start the last segment, and we'll open up the phones. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is Brenda Williams. She is the discoverer, and I'm going to say the caretaker of the Triad Wave. And her website is The Earth Project 777.com. Maybe you can grab one of these pieces during the break. 5 minutes.
It doesn't have the in front of it. It's just Earth Project 777.
Earth Project 777. All right. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading hand. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Not far outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. My guest tonight is Brenda Williams, and her website is earthproject777.com. We're talking about the triad wave, her discovery of it, her ability to verbalize it, and her ability to spread it throughout the world. It's going to have some amazing effects. You know, one of the things we know if you listen to this program a lot, is we're all about the physics and possibilities of things. And when it comes to constructive interference, the whole Fibonacci process, in addition to the sequence, how things build resonance and how they get onto that golden mean of acceptance by the universe, and I'm going to say resonance with the universe energy, so that you can bring that energy from wherever it is on the other side of the dimension, just a millimeter away from your existence, into your life, and make your dreams, make your life happen with energy, with purpose, with remembrance. This wave might be the key to the lock. Open up that lock. Open up the existence for you so that you can see it work in your life. I listened to the musical pieces at this website today while I was working on my project, and it seemed to calm my mind and allow my brain to think about these complex mathematical equations I was working between spreadsheets so that I could make these financial projections work. Usually it's quite nerve-wracking for me, but today it was very calming, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Brenda, for joining us on X Squared Radio. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back, and I can tell you why that worked for you. You were working in a similar way of superlearning. You're working with high alpha with a slow theta, which allows you to have that focus and reasoning, but you're in that high cognitive state of existence, which is the primary function of what the wave does. It gives you that shoot of that high alpha, but you're very alert. We're not asleep, and we're not in deep meditation. And you mentioned the Fibonacci sequencing, which is also one of the sequences of the wave. However, if you look at the Fibonacci sequence, it just continues to go.
Sure.
So we have no way of being able to use it. And so the sequencing allows what we call a foldover, which allows it to reach a particular sequence. And at that time, it folds over on itself, allowing you to have access to all frequencies and vibrations, overtones and undertones that exist. So it puts you in a field, once again, of that unlimited possibility, and gives you the ability to work at a very highly cognitive and fluent way. It's sort of like you go, somebody says, well, you know, how do you know? If you'll listen to the cadence of the voice of people when they're speaking, you can tell if they're thinking, or if they are in that fluid movement of knowing, there is a difference in the cadence of the voice. When you become sensitive to understand how languaging comes in the first place, you begin to know that it's not coming from your head. It's that constant flow. And that's when we're working in that superconscious way, in that highly cognitive information access that is part of the multidimensionality of the human anyway. So you sort of tapped into that because I think you have experience in different ways of utilizing the technology itself. So when you come in contact with it, it's automatically triggering the encoding within you, your personal existence, that begins to bring those perhaps somewhat dormant things online. And that's another one of its functions.
Sure. Well, one of the things about human consciousness that most people don't realize is that memory, it may not be actually in your brain. It may be somewhere
else. Yeah, I don't think it is.
But the brain has a way of lensing it, has a way of layering and what I call transitory relationships, where you take music and mathematics and you take color and you take pressure and texture and all these things relate one to another, and you can copy these sequences over in your mind so that recall becomes more easy, whether it's language or art or mathematics or biology or, you know, anything that might be 3D in nature. And when I relate this to the Fibonacci process, not necessarily the sequence, you could start anywhere at all in the sequence, and start adding numbers together. And when you get to the eighth iteration, you can divide the seventh into the eighth, and you're right back on the golden mean, 1.618 to 1. And Brenda's exactly correct. You can continue to spiral this up and way beyond the audio, which, of course, would do you no good. So I imagine folding it back over and maybe stepping over a little bit and running the sequence again. And so you get all possibilities, but you get them in a 1.618 ever-increasing slope. And that becomes resonating with your consciousness and entrains what is normally a scattered and static mind wave into something that's more focused and flowing.
Very well said.
Let's open the phone line.
Absolutely accurate.
Toll free, 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-413-9537. And we have lots and lots of people that listen on the conference line, which is 805-399-1000. And then dial the passcode 769-608-POUND. That way you can walk around with a sly smile on your face while listening to your cell phone. Everyone else thinks you're listening to someone on a phone call, but you're actually listening to the great ideas here on X Squared Radio. So I don't know if that's accurate or not, Brenda, but it just made sense to me. It's what I got from listening to the music that was on your website at earthproject777.com. Was that close?
Yes, you're actually very close. Frighteningly close in some respects. there are certain parts of it that we really don't talk about a whole lot. But one of the things that happens is when we're building and we're continuing to grow, it's in phases. So when we start with this simple process that we talk about when we do the groups, it's very primary to start with. But the more practiced you become, what people begin to realize is that they're going deeper and deeper and deeper into their awareness. So what we're doing is we're, you know, our we call it, you know, this API, awareness, presence, and intent. Because the more sensory aware we become, the more our information is being delivered, then what happens is we become more present with what's happening around us, which then defines how we talk about or define our intent. So our intent becomes more precise instead of so broad, well, I want this. We begin to refine it so that we begin to invite into our field of existence those things that are truly supportive of us rather than just something because it's there.
Well, so let me tell you,
we're just refining and developing these aspects of who we are as very multidimensional, very multi-refined.
Let me tell you how fun this is. You think, oh man, I don't want to be all stilted. I don't want to have to think a certain way and breathe a certain way. Hold on a minute, because here's what it's like. Picture Walmart on rollerblades. What happens is you begin to move, because when you reach this state of awareness, the things you realize right away, whether you're driving to work or whether you're at work at your cubicle village or whether you're walking through the mall, is that nobody else around you is aware. You're the only one. And so it's like going shopping at Walmart on rollerblades. You move in and out of other people like they're pylons, and you see so much more, and you feel so much more. And what's really wonderful is when you meet another person on rollerblades.
Yes, and there are a lot of people on rollerblades in Walmart right now. I had someone, a few weeks ago say, yeah, but you know, there's just a few of you, and there's a lot of them. And I said, no, I think you've got it wrong. It's my experience that there's a lot of us and very few of them, because they don't exist. We're just different versions of ourselves, and we haven't learned to talk to one another yet.
Interesting.
And so there's a lot of us. There's a whole planet full of us and beyond.
And beyond.
We haven't learned how to communicate similarly with our own physical. So it's back again to, you know, we heard forever, you know, let it begin with me, and, you know, it all starts, you know, with my own understanding and self-awareness and all of that. And it's like they're just words. But what happens when you really begin to understand how you relate to the things that are going on around you in a more fluid way, you find out that there are very few differences. You know, the truth is, we live on a big ball out in the middle of nowhere, and there's no place to go for vacation. So we're all here. We aren't able to go to another planetary system in a ship to go somewhere for vacation.
All we have to do is remember.
In our third-dimensional world, we can't. There's no ships that are lined up at the, you know, tarmac to take us to someplace else for vacation. So how do we begin to learn that our differences are significant, our strength is in our diversity, and yet we're so intent on making everybody the same? I want you to think like me. I want you to eat like me. I want you to live in houses like me. It doesn't matter what your culture was like before. It needs to look just like mine so we can all be on the same plate. No, by the way, my way is right and your way is wrong.
Well, I think within reason, we have become now, with the neural network of the internet, much more accepting of other people's cultures, up to a point.
Yes.
We kind of get rubbed the wrong way when people get their hands and heads hacked off in the town square, and when women can't go to school, and, you know, those kinds of things. We'd like to see those kinds of things change in those cultures. And they may resist that, but this is the 21st century.
Yes.
And you know, we've got to learn to live within the ecosystem of our planet without hacking each other into hamburger.
I would agree. And I think that the way we can do that is for us to begin to understand why and how we come to understand what's going on in the world and why we resist the things that we resist. You know, back in the day, there was a Andrea Puharik went around to world governments saying, you don't understand, but there's a frequency that's being transmitted on this planet that is creating chaos, and it's being transmitted frequently. And, well, yeah, we know. We recognize it. We see it. We understand it. We know when it's being done. Well, what's happened is that we still have a lot of distractions that are creating discord within the human form itself and how we understand it, so we perceive it to be something that it isn't. We do have some recourse now that we can eliminate some of that, and we can stop that. We can stop some of these things that are being transmitted that are creating you know, chaos, people beginning to get irritated, overly irritated.
Now, are these frequent?
You know, just go out and riot.
Are these frequent frequencies being transmitted on purpose to have that effect, or is this a side effect of other things like FM radio and et cetera?
Yes, and yes. And it's not a secret, and it's not a conspiracy. I'm not into conspiracy crap. But the thing of it is, there are things that are happening that we can do something about. But what we have to do is to have the physical to understand how to manage it, how to work with it, how to overcome it, how to disentrain our minds to believe that what we hear. The body can self-regulate, so anybody can transmit whatever they want to, and the body knows how to self-regulate when it reaches that point of receiving and how it translates. So that's a lot of the work with the wave, is that it's bringing the physical back into that self-regulatory state of existence. You know, I go back to a simple story I used to tell a long time ago. I do not believe that the Creator, whatever you deem the Creator to be in your particular belief system, didn't dump me down here on this planet without every mechanism to take care of all the dumb things we were going to do, like pollute our water and, you know, push chemicals out. So within my physical system, there had to be a mechanism that knew how to adjust to those kinds of crazy things, because we knew we were going to do them. Well, the body can, but we have become so entrained to believing that it can't that we are held prisoner to that often. We see something and we automatically think, oh my goodness, I can't touch that because it's bad for me. So we don't touch it. It's back again to how we perceive and how we translate that perception and how it communicates then cellularly within the form itself, whether it self-regulates or not.
I understand that. I think that, you know, by and large, individually, we make choices about what kind of life we're going to have, when we're going to come to this planet, where we're going to be born, and in which, family group, because maybe as we have multiple lives on many worlds, we may have had multiple lives here as well. I don't know if we bounce all over the place. Once we're an Aborigine, and then we're a Nordic skier, and then we're an American Indian. We may stay in the same family lines. And the only reason I say that is because there appears to be enough evidence of alien contact within certain family lines. It doesn't bounce around randomly. They follow one family line over a series of generations, hundreds or even thousands of years. It's just an observation. I was having a business meeting the other night. It was a business dinner with a president of a plastics company. Pretty down-to-earth guy, kind of an adventurer, southern boy, you know, just was talking about his grandbaby and on and on. And somewhere in the middle of the night, I mean, I'm pretty quiet when it comes to, I mostly listen to these companies and try to learn more about them than they know about me, just my way of doing things. But all of a sudden, we're there maybe an hour and a half. We've gone through the mozzarella sticks. We're into the chicken wings now. And he turns to me and says, "So what's your view of the universe?" We're not talking about the universe, Brenda. We're talking about plastic injection molding and thermoforming and all kinds of wonderful manufacturing things. Then he asked me a question like that, so I looked him dead in the eye. And I told him my view of the universe. I said, "We are eternal beings having a mortal experience. We have lived many lives on many worlds, and we are here trying to figure out what the heck we're doing making plastic parts for a living, and we've lost our way." And he got the most wild look on his face. "Well, I'm gonna have to go home and talk that over with my ordained Baptist minister wife. I don't know about that.
I don't know about that.
Just think about it for a while. You asked me the question. And the fact that I'm here and you're here now and you asked that question means you were meant to ask that question at this moment."
And absolutely. That's when it gets to be fun. I had ministers on my board when I was a nonprofit, when Quiet Miracles was a nonprofit back in the 90s. And it was interesting because, of course, I did not reveal a lot, but they did understand that that I had received this in an unusual way. And so the general consensus was, and what I was always asked to say was, "Where does all divine inspiration come from?" And so that became my tagline when someone said, "Well, where did this come from?" And I'd say, "You know, where does all divine inspiration come from?" And it would just sort of, that was about as far as they could go. And yet they knew that there was something interesting and unique. And yet, when they would ask, we'd do experientials or something. One of them in particular, we were doing one of the little experientials that I was doing in one of the schools, and I was sharing it with them at a board meeting. And so I had them all in a circle, and I asked them when we got through, I said, please go back to your seats without talking and just be present for a few minutes, and then we're going to open up dialogue about what you experienced. And one of the ministers was, you know, had been just had this look on his face, and he finally raised his hand, and he said, I have a question. He said, were our feet on the ground? And I said, what do you mean? He said, it felt like we were levitating. Were we levitating? And one of the other guys said, yeah, he said, you know, I was afraid to open my eyes because I didn't know where I was. I thought something was happening. And I said, no, I promise you we were not levitating. But I said, what happens when we reach that other space of existence, we do have a different sense of who we are. And what they came back with was that they would reach some of those places in their own devotional applications and practices and things that they were doing. And they were familiar with it. They just called it something else.
Right.
So that always gives me rise to say, you know, we're having very similar experiences, and I don't believe things happen by coincidence either. So if someone asks me a question, I'm going to give them to the best of my ability. I don't hold it back anymore, and I think that's important. So I agree with you. When he asked the question, he was asking because he was ready for the answer.
Yeah, he was ready for the answer, exactly right.
Might have pondered it for a good long while, but he was ready for it.
Well, I've got to go back to his plant this coming Tuesday, you know, to audit, and so I'm sure he's going to...
He's going to get into that one again.
We'll probably revisit it, and it'll be some more mozzarella sticks and chicken wings, I'm afraid. But
isn't that the, you know, to me, all of these years up to this point have been, I call them just really serious, you know. I mean, it's like getting some of this in place and all of this documentation and all of this, you know, the backstory around some of it was intense. And all of a sudden, 26, I had asked, a while back, I said, you know, when do I punch out? Not leave the planet, because I'm here for the duration. But I said, when do I punch out? And, a year ago or so, it was January 26, 2013. And I thought, wow, that's pretty precise. And so I marked it on my calendar. And so January, you know, we had the 12-21-2012 event that drew so much attention and so much, you know, focus was on that, and it was like, well, that was nice, and so I'm waiting because I want to see now what happens January 26, 2013, because I punch out and didn't know what came next. What am I to do now?
Right. Right. Well, for me, you know, just real quick story, I was dead. I was, you know, early 50s, 250 pounds, wore glasses, had asthma, you know, took high blood pressure medicine. I was an engineer working my life away. Wrote a book, got a chance to go speak at a conference, my first ever. Went out to Trout Lake, Washington, and on August 17th, 2006, went into meditation for the first time since I was probably 18 years old. And I woke up. I woke up. In 30 days, I laid my glasses down for the last time. I laid my asthma medicine down for the last time. I dropped 40 pounds in weight. And someone saw me a year later. I went back to speak at that same conference. And I watched the film myself of the 2 years. The man that came in 2006 was 10 years older than the man that came in 2007.
But you couldn't tell it, could you?
Oh, yeah. I could tell.
You didn't look 10 years older, did you?
No. I mean, the person that went home on August 18th was a different person that went out there August 16th.
Yes.
My kids noticed it. My wife noticed it. Everyone who knew me my whole life noticed it. I felt like I had been asleep for 40 years. I just woke up. And everything's different since.
It's an exciting time right now, isn't it?
I'm amazed. I look at what I've done in the last 7 years, and I compare it to what I did the previous 30 years, and there's no comparison. No comparison at all. It's a totally different exponential level of life. And that's one of the reasons why I started X Squared Radio, because I thought somehow, some way, we got to tell this story enough ways with enough experts like Brenda out there to say, wake up, start living. This whole planet will change because of you, Brenda, and what you're doing.
Well, I think that's true for everyone. I have a piece of the puzzle. I do not have all the answers. I have what's always been referred to as the concrete platform. Everything can build on it. We try to build a house and we put the roof on, but we don't have the sides up yet, so the roof doesn't stay. And we've been building things from the outside in for so long, and wondering why are we not working? They're not bad ideas. They're not bad programs. They're not bad modalities. Why can't we have sustainability? And it's back again to we constantly look outside of ourselves instead of holding that resonant field. If we could get a critical mass of people who all they did was hold their resonant field and live their life in joy, because that's what holding a resonant field will give you. So holding that resonant field, we make the change one by one, but we make it in a ripple that just exponentially moves out through the universes. And we can do that. It's all about what you're willing to do for yourself. It's like, you know, the airline stewardesses and the things we don't ever watch, you know, mothers or people with, you know, caretaking children or whatever, if we have some reason that the oxygen masks come down, please put it on your face first before you give it to your child. Well, as a mother, the first thing you're going to do is slap it on the kid. And then you're out, and he doesn't know what to do.
Right.
So it is about, you know, healer, heal yourself. Please, how do we get people to understand that if your life is in confusion and in inner conflict, you're not going to be part of the solution, no matter how marvelous your ideas are.
So you're not going to be able to hold your breath for a minute and a half to put that mask on your kid and then get yours on.
No. So it's, you know, we've got to start understanding how we can make a difference. Because creating a new idea, you know, I was working with a group and you know, they're wanting to bring in all these new concepts and all. And all I could say was, you know, you just opened the door. You threw the baby, the bathtub, the water, the wash rag, and the soap out.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You need to bring the bathtub, the baby, the wash rag, and the soap back in and fill it up with new water, because there wasn't anything wrong with the baby, the bathtub, the soap, or the wash rag. You just had dirty water. So
yep.
Why is it we want to just throw everything away and create something new? We do not have to recreate the wheel.
Because we have bureaucracies.
Plenty of solutions.
Because we have government bureaucracies that make money doing that.
Oh, absolutely.
They're professional baby water, bath water thrower-outers. Well, I tell you, I've had a marvelous time. Where do we go?
I have too. Thank you.
Oh, very, very welcome. Where does the wave go from here now? You're going to redo your website at earthproject777.com.
Right. We're getting ready to put up more music. I've got quite a few more pieces that are going to be going on, a couple videos that are going to be going on, and bringing in a whole new segment of the old, what I refer to as the Quiet Miracles, models or templates that will give some ideas as to how you can apply this in mainstream environments, like with how does it work in education, how does it work within medical arenas, how does it work in these different environments that have already been, you know, we've already got the template ready to show how to take that into those environments. with whatever you're bringing in. Remember, this is what you include and incorporate in what you're doing. And so it adds that element of sustainability to whatever you're doing. And yes, it would work in your plastics. so we're looking at how to bring that information online and make it available so that people can understand that this is not something they have to, you know, go to a lot of extreme to understand how to do. The simplicity of it is something that becomes who you are because it already is. And then you take what you have come here to share out into the world.
Well, Brenda, you're a wonderful speaker and you have a wonderful voice and a wonderful mannerism. Are you doing any workshops? Are you running a school? Are you over there near Raleigh?
Well, actually, no. I'm actually sitting in a 125 square foot little cabin in the middle of Middle Tennessee. I'm just a little bit south of Nashville. And I have been working out of this area. I've been coming back and forth to what we call Command Center is what this has ultimately been, because it's been very prominent in the evolution of this whole process for me. And so I'm here. I came back here from I was in L.A. for a while and in Sedona for a while. Came back here in, I believe it was August, and determined that I was going to stay because it was time for me to tell the story. So it seems that the story is something that will trigger experiences that other people are having, because what's happening is that a lot of the population is going to be now having that higher awareness integrated into their form, because we have moved quite a bit forward. So how do we give them some guidelines and give them some tools to use for that assimilation to be comfortable? So we just got through with two series of the group calls. We'll be starting another series it's supposed to start week after next. I haven't put it up on the website yet, and the form stacks have just come in. So, but we'll be starting some of those three-week phone calls that are group calls that are open to people to come in and learn the foundational pieces of it. Then we'll be setting up. We'll be doing a training probably here in Nashville. I do go around and you know, speak and do things. I just got through doing a weekend in Nashville last weekend, which was quite interesting. It was actually with a group of people who are considered walk-ins, and they wanted to understand what happens with that, and how does the physiology actually work with that. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of a hodgepodge of all kinds of different things that we can talk about, depending on what application you have. If it's a mainstream, then we can address that. If it's not mainstream, we can talk about that too.
Yeah, it's a little difficult for people to understand that I walked out on my back porch, looked out over the water, and all of a sudden I woke up in the body of a 9-year-old boy here. So, yeah, I know what you mean.
So some of it, I tend to have what I'm told is that I can talk about it very, you know, it's not a big deal. My experience has not been a big deal to me. It's just been a matter of how I've experienced my life in the last 20 years. And because it's so carefully documented with pictures and everything else, it's a fun story. And that's what it's about. It's about enjoying it. So yes, it's these kinds of communications are fun.
Yes, they are. I've enjoyed myself tonight. I hope you have too.
I certainly have. I'm delighted that you were able to reach me. This was very strange. I guess that's the best way anyway.
Yep, that's the way it's supposed to be.
We are always prepared to do what we have come here to do.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel pretty unprepared, but I managed to get through it anyway.
Yeah, we are prepared. trust me on that one. I know that to be the truth. We are prepared, well prepared to do what we do. And the more we come together and the more we communicate and dialogue with one another and understand how our puzzle pieces fit into a larger puzzle, we begin to see what the bigger picture looks like. I don't think we'll ever see it all, but we're going to see a pretty big chunk of it, and it's...
Yep, well, we get a good look at it right here, and that's one of the wonderful things about the web is it allows us to propagate these ideas freely, unfettered, without censorship, and allows you, the listener, to tune in anytime you like. As you know, there are archives at xsquaredradio.com and also bbsradio.com. And we'll send a link to you, Brenda, so that you can send your friends here, because this has been a really exceptional interview, and I appreciate it so much.
Thank you. I would like to get in touch with you. So now you're in somewhere south of you're around North Carolina, right?
I'm around Charlotte, but I do a lot of business in Middle Tennessee. I helped launch the Nissan Altima, so I lived in Smyrna, Tennessee for a while. Did a lot of business in Franklin and Nashville.
Well, so, then you're just right up the road from me.
Yep.
So just give me a holler when you're coming this way.
Absolutely will. Absolutely will. Friends for life. And thank you, Stephanie. I know you're out there listening.
Absolutely, Stephanie. Thank you. she has been quite a little advocate for this for the last little while. She's... introduce me to some very interesting people, and I'm ready to talk about it now. I just haven't been until now.
Well, welcome back. We're glad you didn't leave for very long.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you again. I do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a tremendous week, Brenda. Thank you so much.
You do too. I'll talk to you again.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, that was Brenda Williams, and I just had a wonderful time with her. If you missed the first hour of the interview, it will be posted on the archives, both at bbsradio.com and xsquaredradio.com. Just had a wonderful time. Got about 10 minutes left. I want to... phone lines are still open, by the way, 888-429-5471. And I'm almost going to thank you for not calling, because we had such a great conversation going there. Just didn't want it to go in another direction, which it often does. We don't screen our calls. Sometimes they call in and say, hey, how's the Hollow Earth going? Oh, okay, it's going fine, but we're not talking about the Hollow Earth tonight. We're talking about the Triad Wave with Brenda Williams. For a really, really great interview. At the end of the first hour, we were beginning to talk about the currency wars, and I wanted to leave this with you because it's important that you know it. The balance of power in the currency wars now rests with, I know this is really going to surprise you, Japan. It's true, according to the banks. As Japan's policymakers... more dovish approach looks set to bring the world a step closer to a currency war. Now, what does this mean for you? It means a lot. The Bank of Japan doubled its inflation target to 2% in January and made an open-ended commitment to continue buying assets from next year. This follows a leadership change with new Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. That means shrimp, by the way. Openly calling for aggressive monetary stimulus from the country's central bank. One of the things that a lot of people don't know is that Japan has a very high debt-to-GDP ratio. However, its currency is quite strong. Now, this move, Morgan Stanley said, is a game-changer, as Japan tries to invigorate its stagnating economy. You think we've had a recession here? They've been going through a recession for about 20 years. If a weaker yen is an important pillar of the strategy to make this export-oriented economy more competitive again, it brings into the picture something that was missing from earlier interactions among central banks of the advanced economies: competitive depreciation. Now, that is an important term. It in turn takes us one step closer to a currency war. Now, you don't remember what that is because we didn't have really great communications the last time we really had one of these. So I want to make sure to bring this history to you so you could know what's going on. When you talk about to companies, sometimes they say, oh, yeah, we made a lot of money in Europe, but we lost money because of the exchange rate. That's not a currency war. Okay? Manoj Pradhan was an economist at the bank, and he details the 1930s war and highlights the lessons that we can learn from the past. The UK was the first to leave the gold standard on September 19th in 1931, okay, due to painfully high unemployment. Ring a bell? Ring a bell? Okay. Sterling depreciated, setting off a volatile chain of events with the U.S., Norway, Sweden, France, Germany all following suit. This was huge. Those countries that moved early, they benefited at the expense of others on the gold block. A beggar thy neighbor outcome, according to Pradhan. Similarly, it is the domestic agenda that could drive competitive depreciation today. Okay, China does it on purpose. We know that. We label them as a currency manipulator. That's what they do. They keep their currency cheap so that they can constantly export their product. It creates jobs for their country, but as you can see, it depresses jobs in other countries. Why? Because manufacturers move their businesses to China to take advantage of that cheap currency, and then they export those products back to the United States, from which they come, and sell those products at much lower prices. Since global demand is likely to remain sluggish, a revival of Japan's export sector on the back of the yen weakness is likely to eat into market share of other exporters, something that could well invite measures to curb significant weakening of the yen. Now, you might see it as an advantage because you can go buy a Toyota or a Nissan or one of the other Japanese brands, Honda, at a cheaper price. Or you get a better car at the same price. Why? Because Japan is about to do what China has been doing for a long, long time. They're about to competitively depreciate their currency. In a detailed scenario of what could follow, Pradhan highlights that the European Central Bank and Federal Reserve would ease further using quantitative easing, or what's called QE, to dampen euro strength and debt ceiling fears. How did they do that? They print money. Capital controls could be brought in by Latin America and other Asian economies, he said, which could be transaction taxes or even some form of verbal interaction. In the particularly interesting case of Korea and Taiwan, our economist Sharon Lam believes that verbal intervention already underway to some extent, this is intervention in the foreign exchange markets and capital controls, represents the most likely policy reactions. While a currency war is not our base case, after all, it has been about 80 years since we had one, the newfound commitment of Japan's policymakers does raise the risk of retaliatory action to keep the yen weak. The experience of the 1930s suggests to us that such large currency crises are likely triggered by domestic issues, and that they do create distinct winners and losers. Emerging market policymakers are already gearing up to make sure they remain on the winning side, but the balance of power now rests with Japan. I told you 2 weeks ago on this program that the global economy had written Japan off. Japan's debt-to-GDP ratio was so high, about 326%, and Japan was also not buying as many U.S. treasuries as it had in the past. Fukushima had taken a huge bite out of them in addition to a 20-year-long recession. And the global economists had written Japan off. And now, this week, announcements are made that Japan is going to competitively depreciate its currency and create a weaker yen. When that happens, believe me, people that buy and sell currency will buy yen and will sell dollars. And that's exactly what we don't want to have happen. You understand what that means? It's a currency war. When you have a large disparity in the price between currencies that's artificially maintained in a globally trading currency, you will create a feeding frenzy for brokers. Those people like George Soros that are out there trading currencies. Remember George Soros? You've heard the name in political circles. But he became a billionaire by breaking the Bank of England. He broke it. He traded currencies so aggressively that he bankrupted the Bank of England. That's how George Soros became a billionaire. You have just created, with this writing off of Japan and forcing them to competitively depreciate their currency, push the yen lower in order to remain competitive on an export trade balance world. You have now created a perfect chummed ocean for the sharks, that there are now a lot more billionaires than when George Soros came on the scene. And there are way more billionaires than there were in the 1930s. You're going to see huge sell-offs of equity in order to buy and sell currencies. And when currencies are buying and selling, the banks are not loaning. When the banks are not loaning, nothing is getting built. It's too irresistible. It's like knowing the secret to the slot machine. It's like playing blackjack with a single deck for these guys. They know how to count cards. They have computers that trade so fast. The computers are faster than any computer you could personally buy. And they bank the computers together and link them together with high-speed switching systems so they can make these trades. It's coming. Make sure you hold on to your cash. Make sure you get into your hard metals and protect yourself. I've told you 100 times to sell your 401k. It may be too late for that now. Anyway, I'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Remember, Earth Explorers, to look for the good in others and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. Remember, you are our source. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.